Good afternoon, everyone. So let me introduce myself briefly. My name is Avi Jenny. I am a legal director in an international law firm, Hill Dickinson. I'm a corporate and transactional lawyer. Ship or vessel acquisition and the corresponding investment and finances are my main practice area. So today we're going to discuss topics from Chartra's perspective, the evolving trends in geopolitics, regulations, technology fuels, and decarbonization, which are very interesting topics personally to me, because these topics are or aspects could heavily impact the transactions and the project-driven work that I do on a daily basis. So it's very good to have the experts here together with us. So we have a stellar group, big names of panelists in the marine and energy industries. I will let do the honor of the panelists to introduce themselves.
Okay. Please,
sir, you can go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Stevie, and thanks for the invitation, Capital Link as well. So I'm Peter Lai. I'm the executive head of shipping for the Anglo-American Group. We're a diversified mining company across many geographies and many commodities, including coal, copper, iron ore, chrome and nickel. As I mentioned, I look after all the ocean freight activity within Anglo. We're probably a little bit different. We about a third of our portfolio is non-Anglo or non-equity cargo. So that's a little bit unique in that we provide chartering and shipping services in-house, but we also operate independently in the market for third parties as well. We see that as an opportunity for us to manage our supply chain risk, as well as generate additional value for our stockholders. Thank you.
Sarah?
Thanks. My name is Sarah Greener. I'm the head of Maritime Enterprise at BHP. We ship all sorts of commodities, again, another mining company, iron ore, coal, copper, nickel, uranium, and we do that across a range of vessel types, from bulk, break bulk, containerized freight as well. We'll soon be adding a new commodity to our portfolio, potash, in the coming years as well.
So my name is Andrew Hoare. I'm the head of green shipping at Fortescue, which is also an Australia mining group, but also we consider ourselves to be a mining, energy and integrated technology group as well. My specific responsibility in the group is particularly to drive the adoption of ammonia as a marine fuel, as well as developing other technologies within the Fortescue group, along with electrification, marine batteries, and ammonia fuel delivery systems as well.
Yeah, Scott, please.
Yeah, my name is Scott Bergeron. I'm a member of the board of Oldendorf Carriers, and specific responsibility for our own fleet of ocean-going vessels and our transshipment units.
Hi, everyone. I'm Laure Bargin, head of commercial operations for Rio Tinto, a mining and metal company. Part of my responsibility cover for all our inbound and outbound supply chains at sea and on land. And we're essentially shipping on the dry bulk sector, particularly a bit more than 320 million tons of product, essentially iron ore, bauxite, alumina, and as well as metals, but more on the container sites.
Hello, good afternoon to all. I'm Rodrigo Vermelho. I'm the head of shipping of Vale. Vale is a Brazilian mining company. We transport more than 300 million tons of iron ore per year. I'm a naval architect as background, and my responsibility is oversee this maritime transportation of iron ore, ensuring that this is done in a very safe, competitive, and sustainable way.
Thanks a lot, everyone. Very, very impressive role and responsibilities in your respective company, I suppose. So first of all, I would like to touch on decarbonization aspect. So we all know that the decarbonization targets have become more ambitious in recent years. Regulations are more stringent on emission reduction. Various aspects or various actions need to be taken to reduce emissions today, and energy efficiency measures can deliver short-term emission reductions while also reducing costs to charters and ship owners. The effect and the suitability of each energy efficiency measure would heavily depend on various aspects of the vessel itself, such as her type, her size, and her location, the shipbuilders and location, voyages, and routes. So my first question to all the panelists is, what do you think, or can you share your views on how the maritime sector is keeping up in terms of decarbonization, technology, alternative fuels within the past 12 months, and how do you actually compare it, you know, the development and the improvement compared to the last year? I would welcome Peter to make
some
comments.
Yeah, sure. It's a pretty meaty question. absolutely. No, look, I think from our perspective, I mean, when we look at the last 12 months to start with, and then maybe sort of thinking more conceptually around how we see things. But I think, look, it's definitely challenging times. You know, I think, you know, we as an industry should be really, really proud, I think, of what we've done.
Yeah.
Over the last, you know, decade or so, we've made some really good progress, and I think some of the reports that have come out, whether it's Sea Cargo Charter or some of the IMO data, is definitely, you know, promising, and we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves in relation to that. But I think that sort of next step, and we're seeing that with some of the IMO targets, is definitely quite challenging. And I think that's why, you know, this year and what comes out of those discussions will be really, really critical for us being able to make the next step collectively. Look, I think from our perspective at Anglo, I mean, we very much have a view it's a multi-fuel sort of vessel efficiency sort of ESD approach to reducing emissions in ocean freight. You know, what we try to do is to be really genuine and authentic around the actions that we take, and make sure we're doing something that's really sustainable and sticky with our customers, and that's not always easy in the current environment. We believe, you know, that those gains and improvements towards zero emissions, it's more about, you know, being practical and starting to shift the dial rather than putting all your eggs in one basket. You know, we applaud the first movers, you know, very excited around some of the things that we see. But we also see there's a lot of opportunity in current fuels as well, as they can become greener and help shift the dial forward. So we've always been very much aligned to the mantra that you should not forego the good for a perceived perfect. And I think that's something that we've always tried to do, and we see that in our you know, in our numbers, in the positive gains that we've been able to achieve in our activity. So action-wise for us, I think more in the short term, given, you know, there are some challenges, it's very much around continuing to improve efficiency. How can we reduce ballast legs on our cargoes and get more benefit through just better use of the vessels? Expanding some of our coverage around LNG, where it's on the water, it's working, it's efficient. You know, that's getting some positive results for us. But then also looking at some of the other opportunities that exist on the greener fuels, and not just in big ships, I think in small ships as well. That's an area that we sometimes forget, and that's a big component of our portfolio. So I think that's how we sort of see it. But again, I think we should be proud as an industry in terms of what we've done, not be too hard on ourselves, but we still have a lot of work to do.
Thank you so much for that. Sarah, would you like to comment on that as well, please?
Yeah, I think I'll just sort of further extend on Peter's response. I think, you know, whether look back in the last 12 months or even the last couple of years, I think the industry has made some great crossroads and progression towards, you know, the zero emission fuel landscape. However, I think we were probably a little ambitious or a little optimistic around fuel availability, you know, and the time horizon of that, particularly around sort of green ammonia supply chains and even availability of biofuels and biofuel supply chains as well. So I think progress is happening, and we have made some inroads, but certainly still a lot of work to do.
All right. Andrew?
I think from my perspective, it's probably almost a year now that we concluded the world's first transfer and bunkering operation of ammonia dual-fuel vessels. I think that was quite an achievement for the year. And other groups have also achieved that as well, NYK and Amogy. So I think from a carbon-free fuel, which is the fuel that ammonia is, that Fortescue is making a choice, I think there's been phenomenal progress. We worked through with the Singapore authorities to get the fuel mandated through IMO MSC. That was achieved then in December 2024. So I think over the last 12 months, the enablement of this fuel has been achieved. Of course, we'll probably come later in this panel to look ahead on what's happening in the IMO at this time. Frankly, it's happening now. It's not happening in April. The discussions are happening now. I think the problem we face today is, yes, we have a multi-fuel environment, and therefore we're rather adopting a rather scattered gun approach with ports and facilities looking at multiple infrastructure from LNG, biofuels, ammonia, and of course the traditional fuels as well. So I think we're definitely in a period where we need a lot of clarity, and currently we don't have that clarity as an industry.
Scott,
I'll turn the question around a little bit. I'll talk more about what we're not doing, I think, rather than sitting here and rah, 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 how great we are. We're in the commodity market, and transportation of commodities is pretty efficient, but we're not climate deniers. But as an industry, we haven't agreed on a metric yet. You know, what does it mean to reduce, and how are we going to achieve these net zero targets? And, you know, they have the 2008 baseline, they revised it for 2018, but, you know, still we have difficulty, and we came out very publicly against CII because we felt that's a very flawed metric that did some unintended consequence motivation. We have a very simple metric. It's how much CO2 do you emit moving this amount of commodity from here to there? And then you can measure that year on year, and you can have a real target to reduce, and that's actual emission reductions. But when we come to these conferences, what we don't hear is the efficiency of energy. And this is the precious resource. We're trying to get away from fossil fuels. What is that next energy? And we in shipping have not found a way to find the prioritization with other modes of transport. And if we talk about the e-fuels, and these are fuels that are basically using solar or wind-generated power to then ultimately crack hydrogen to put it in a liquid or some type of transportable form, like ammonia or methanol. By the time you have the energy loss to the wake of the ship, we're talking as much as 80% energy loss. And as a society, I don't think we can afford that level of loss. So if we talk about electrification, we should be talking about road transport. All right, if we're talking about sustainable biofuels, we should be talking about aviation. And we need to find what is most efficient for shipping. So that's where I think we're not doing, is having the big picture in mind where we're operating in the vacuum of our industry. And it's time for us to broaden that discussion.
Yeah, Laura?
Thanks.
Would you like to comment on this as well?
It's definitely a good challenge to open up and see in the end, you know, where is the best use of this renewable or future fuels. I think we've discussed over the past years, you know, what can we do now, and particularly this week's theme, so where action meets ambition. We talked a lot about the energy efficiency and how we could accelerate the delivery of the some of the very low-hanging fruit. We've been at Rio able to crack a little bit, you know, this paradigm that we had where we wanted the ship owners to install energy saving devices, for example, but then how to finance it. So today, as we speak, we have achieved 40% carbon intensity reduction in 2024, 6 years ahead of the IMO target, and we are on our track to deliver the 50% by 2030. And how we've done that is not only basically testing and implementing some of these ESDs on board our own vessels, but also, of course, selecting the most efficient vessels, as well as basically co-funding the installation of these ESDs for the time charters that we're using. So we're very much believing, because the future of these fuels will be a costly bill for all of us, that any fuel saved is the first thing to do, and how to accelerate that. With, again, energy-saving devices, also larger vessels that we're using, and we're engaging essentially with our port and terminals as well as our customers to see how they can take larger sizes vessel as well as optimization of the routing. So very much the focus on the short term and medium term. We have now 10 dual fuel LNG vessels, and we are happy as well to leverage this availability in the market whilst preparing the future, be it with green methanol or green ammonia, which I'm sure we'll touch base later.
Well, much is said that decarbonization is the challenge of our generation, and I think it's still a lot of things to be done. But in general, I'm very satisfied with the progress with the industry. I think what we have achieved in shipping compared to other industries is quite remarkable. At Vale, decarbonization is at the center of the strategy. We want to be a company that supports a low-carbon future. And in terms of shipping, about 5-6 years ago, we launched an R&D program testing different technologies and designing vessels for alternative fuels. And what we see recently is the good results of our pilots and the collaboration that we established with the ship owners, more and more ship owners coming close to us to understand and share information, lessons learned, and be more open to deploy these technologies, as well as developing designs that now can achieve 78% emissions reductions. Of course, it depends on the availability of the fuel, but we can see the designs are there. And so I think that despite being a very conservative industry, I think we have made very good progress. And despite the challenge, I'm very optimistic that we can find a solution for the decarbonization of shipping.
Thanks a lot for that. That's very, very insightful and interesting, very in-depth analysis as well. Specifically for Sarah, I would like to ask in relation to new generation of fuels. To fulfill the IMO goals and, you know, to take the maritime industry to the next level of decarbonization, we need future generation of fuels, right? So in your view, are there gaps between the regulation of, you know, regulating the future fuels or the carbon value change in the marine industry?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's many gaps and challenges, and I think these have been well documented over the years. Availability of a green fuel supply chain is absolutely at the core of it, and I think we're seeing a lot of, you know, gaps in infrastructure readiness and particularly stakeholder readiness along, you know, whether it's disport, load port, bunkering as a critical challenge. Technology, I think, is also a major gap here, you know, about particularly investment risk, what to buy when, and, you know, there's a lot of risk that has been put onto owners to make that critical decision. Also, I guess, regulation, you know, very slow policy coordination happening. We're seeing national, regional, and global policy deployed at differing times, and obviously with that comes a cost to comply as well. And then, you know, on the last panel we heard about the financial side and the financial barriers as well. So, you know, the accessing capital, particularly for small to medium-sized owners, is challenging, and not to mention, you know, the first movers, financially disadvantaged potentially. How do we ensure that we all move together in as one and making sure that the cost to decarbonize is shared across the value chain as much as possible, and not just sort of passed down to the end customer.
Okay, thanks a lot for that. I face regulatory gaps all the time in my transactions, you know, because parties, particularly if you when I handle cross-border transactions, this jurisdiction says this the other jurisdiction says that, and then you parties need to agree in the middle, basically, and then who's going to bear the cost to improve the vessels and et cetera. So it's very interesting aspect. Rodrigo, I would like to ask you a question, particularly in relation to Vale's decarbonization and the relevant technologies that the company has been using. So I note that Vale recently adopts wind power on its world's largest ore carrier. She's called the Vale Max. She's the world's largest ship with a wind propulsion system. Obviously, this is a breakthrough in decarbonization technology, as wind energy will play a significant role in this global exercise. So tell us more about this, the success story of this, these pilots.
Well, energy efficiency has always been part of the strategy of Vale because it's key in terms of competitiveness. But of course, more recently, because of the challenge of decarbonization, we have intensified our efforts on these areas. And I said that we launched an R&D program called EcoShipping, where we aim to identify in the market all types of technologies that could contribute to the challenge of decarbonization. We mapped various technologies. We are implementing different pilots in terms of electric efficiency, hydrodynamic efficiency. And of course, the wind appears as an important element in this strategy. Of course, we all know, we study history, that wind has been the origins of the shipping, has allowed us to sail everywhere and transport the goods. But somehow we have forgot this after the fossil fuels provided cheap and easy energy for everyone. But I think it's a very rational option to go back to wind and try to harvest this type of energy again. We did our first pilot in 2021, was a Guaiba Max, after 2 years studies, conceptual computational models and scale testing on a Guaiba Max. And more recently, we installed the sails on a Vale Max. At the moment, there are 5 vessels with sails on our fleets, and 2 more vessels to be with sails during this year. It's the largest wind-assisted fleets, I think, in the dry bulk market, perhaps in the entire shipping community. And I think the results are very promising. We were aiming to achieve up to 80% energy savings. Of course, wind is not something that you can measure only on one voyage and guarantee that you achieve that sales, because wind is seasonal. You have to relearn how to harvest this energy and have the best routes and capture all the potential that it has. But in general, we have some voyages that we can achieve more than 8% and some voyages that we are within our target. So we are very satisfied, and I think that wind will play a key role in the decarbonization of the industry. What happens today is due to our pilots, which were aimed to accelerate the maturity of the technology and also develop this technology for the specific trade that we do, and of course identify opportunities for competitiveness. So what we see today is a lot of ship owners, when they want to test this kind of technology, they come to us because they know that we have a knowledge, we measure the equipment, we collect the data, and we can cooperate with them. I think a huge part of our efforts also to develop this knowledge and share this knowledge with the industry. We don't aim to be the only one using one technology, be the saver of this problem, but also to collaborate, to work in cooperation. I think it's key to achieve the targets of decarbonization.
Thanks a lot. And just for my reference, how to plan and, vessels that will last for like 30 years or so, taking the advantages of your technologies and fuels, etc.
Well, I think I take this question in a few perspectives. In terms of energy efficiency, my advice would be we always have always installed the state of art in terms of technology, because it will always pay off. In the future, where fuel tends to be more and more expensive, when you invest in energy efficiency, maybe it doesn't make really an economic sense now, but as the world is very dynamic, it will make sense in the future. So if you look at all our generations of vessels, they always have state of art technology. And so this is the first point. Now, in terms of alternative fuels, we have a slightly different approach. I think the approach is to have always to make small steps, always one step ahead, and keep your optionalities open. because we are talking of multi-fuel world. So we don't really know what will be the fuel. If there will be one fuel that will be the champion of this situation. And so we have to be ready to adapt, but we want to make a first step. So if you take, for example, the Falemax second generation, which we designed 10 years ago, they were already LNG ready. The LNG regulations were not ready at that moment, and we were designing vessels that were prepared to receive an LNG system. And as we didn't install LNG, we actually moved with this step to design how this vessel type could receive other type of fuels. So we evolved to have multi-fuel design. So today our new projects, when we work on new projects, of course we have a preference. We have a first step that we like to take, but we also design the vessels for different type of fuels. So if you take next generation of Guaibamax, they will be methanol bunker, but they also have LNG ready notation, ammonia ready notation, and they have a design that can retrofit these fuels in the future. So this gives you some confidence that you can make a first step, but also give you the option to change the course in the future if the regulation changes, the market changes. So I think this gives you the necessary background to move.
Thanks so much for that. I suppose safety is a major aspect as well in part of maintaining the vessels and her performances. And on that note, Laure, I would be interested to know, if you could share your views on safety and crew welfare as well, and the training of the crew. Towards technology to keep them up with the current technology and safety measures. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Evie. We spoke a lot about decarbonization, and the Maritime Just Transition Task Force identified that there will be more or less 800,000 additional seafarers that will need to be brought to deliver on the decarbonization goals with, as we heard, new technologies. New fuels that also brings and carry their own specific risks that we need to deal with. So safety and welfare is paramount as well as we are evolving in the industry towards decarbonization. Why are we so much focusing collectively on safety and welfare is unfortunately in the dry bulk sector and also in shipping overall, the statistics are not good. Out of the 2 million seafarers that exist in the industry, we have a fatality every 3 to 4 days. Actually, 2 weeks ago, if you've seen, with the geopolitical conflicts, that's increased also the risk. A missile killed 4 seafarers on attacking their ships in Odessa, for example. So this component is when you see also across the when you speak about welfare, we speak about even just complying with working and living condition. If you look at the violations that exist today in the industry, unfortunately. It has increased to 7,200 violations in 2023 compared to 6,000 in 2022. So the industry has to really uplift significantly the safety and maturity on board the vessels and amongst all the industry players to ensure that we can attract and retain talent. And not because it's just the right thing to do, but because it's also a license to operate efficiency, operational efficiencies that are delivered as well through safer practices going forward. So it's important across the industry and very much around this table with very much focus towards the delivery on the uplifting the safety aspect of it, in making sure that we can abide by standards, whether they are as far as safety standard. At Rio, we've chosen the dry BMS as the safety standard that we are working actually with our designated owner and operators, which are rallying behind us over the past 2 years to implement the standards at the company level, along with the SSI standards on the crew welfare point of view, to really uplift this maturity. And we are committed to basically charter vessels with this pool of designated owner and operators that are on the journey to uplift the maturity component. Standardization is one part. The other part is we need to have far more reporting in the industry that enables us to understand where you know we have gaps and how can we share best practices to uplifting again the safety aspect. So everything that is a focus in this group as well is to make sure that we are looking at a sharing incident so that we can learn and adjust as well our standards and our practices to really significantly progress on the gaps that that we see.
Thank you. Any other panelists would like to comment on safety issues? Obviously, it's a major part of the part of vessel operation.
Yeah, look, reinforce what Laura said. I think, and I'm sure all of us on the panel will agree. You know, absolutely, no one should get hurt moving our cargoes. And I think the effort that a lot of the large mining companies, if I can use a collective, has been something that's been really important and really transitional, you know, for the industry. I think what is encouraging moving forward, as well as the wellness aspect and all the work, hard work that's been done over the past few decades to certainly improve on the dry bulk, and there's still absolutely some ways to go. I think, you know, not to jump it back into the decarb space, but I think as we move into that multi-fuel future, there are some challenges for seafarers in that space, and I think what we're really encouraged about is hearing some of the efforts that the likes of Singapore, and we've heard Aditi recently that the UK as well, where we have some vessels flagged that are also working extremely hard on the training front to ensure that our seafarers, when we do you know, change these vessels and move forward in a greener space, that they're going to be absolutely well equipped and looked after from a training and a regulatory perspective. Still quite a ways to go, I'm sure, but it's encouraging to hear that from obviously two of the largest flags.
Any other comments, please?
Yeah, I'd just like to say we shouldn't underestimate the burden that we're putting on the seafarers more and more. There's a relentless attack on the requirements and the bureaucracy that we're expecting them to comply with. And when I visit our ships and we have our crew coming through our offices, I continually remind them not to take unnecessary risks. And life is hard enough. Shipping is has its inherent risks, being out sailing the oceans. But I think there's this mindset by many seafarers that they're somehow doing the company a favor if they take some shortcuts. And this is like a continual refrain to us is, don't take these shortcuts. You're not doing us, the company, a favor. And the worst thing is to have to contact their family to say they're not coming home.
Yeah.
I think just to add on safety, I know we don't make this a safety conference, but I think the learnings from our ammonia project is really, really do listen to the crew on board, because they will give you the best direction as to what is required. Too many times safety is imposed from the shore without a good understanding of what actually works on the ship. I think that's really important. We've given that feedback to the RMO SecGen directly when he was on the bridge. The other thing he said, crew member said, is how can I sail safely down the Malacca Strait? So I'm looking up the pilots, I'm fitting in 12 new reports for different charters and relets, whatever else, and I'm thinking about potentially doing an ammonia or methanol bunkering, whatever else. So I think it's really important to digitalize a lot of the activity, some of the backroom work that the crew do, so that they can actually really focus on the task at hand, which will become more complex.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for those views, guys. Moving on, specifically to Andrew, I would like to know about the success stories in relation to four tasks. You know, recent launch of the Green Pioneer. She's a trial ammonia-fueled industrial service vessel that you own, that Fortesque own. She's, my understanding is that she's currently docked in South Quay in London as part of worldwide tour. So
I'll try not to do too much rah-rah otherwise. but I think really, a big mining group, what are we doing? It's a demonstrator vessel. I think we met the headlines last year on that. But what we're trying to do now, obviously in April this year, significant decision to be made in the INO. So the first prong of our world tour, number one, is to say the technology is available and ready and workable today. We worked through that, as I said in my introduction, with the Armo MSC. Also, as we also know from the LNG example, you can find that things may be ready, regulations may be out there, but nobody moves for whatever reason and so forth. So what we want to do is to make sure that at the same time there's a simultaneous adoption of these new fields. We know, and I'm not going to mention ports or home ports, but I can say that we went to the Port of Southampton, not a small city in the UK, and we conducted ammonia operations in that port. I know elsewhere in the world, it takes a long time. Yes, you can take ammonia, for example, but over there on the horizon, don't bring it in. So it's quite a symbolic act to be able to do that in the UK, and they were very, very supportive. I think the other thing, we also just talk about messaging to the IMO. We know, and we're very concerned, that we blame the IMO as actually the permanent representative that they're going to vote to that system. But we need to be very, very clear what is actually going to be agreed to the IMO, because what we can see, it is very likely that fuels, biofuels can be less than 25 grams per joule of, by megajoule of CO2. That's all very good. There's a high chance that they will continue to be incentivized. Now, that sounds fine. That helps, people invest in bunker barges for biofuels and so forth. But the problem being is you're still not eliminating the carbon problem, and you're going to find that these new measures are likely to continue to incentivize LNG and the biofuels, and they're not going to stretch to the newer fuels such as the green ammonia. So what will happen is the biofuels are likely to receive incentives because they need that credential. But then as the mandates in aviation come out, you're going to see the biofuels whipped away, and then you're going to suddenly see price escalation there, and you're not going to have an alternative. Same with LNG. They will begin to face the penalties for the greenhouse emissions that they have for the methane slip. We're seeing a little bit of that indirectly in Europe as well. But ultimately, when we look at world-to-wake measures, LNG is going to face the wrath of a world-to-make assessment on its greenhouse gas contribution. And that's also going to be a challenge. LNG only reduces CO2 by 20%. In the meantime, while we're pondering all this, nothing has then been put in and allocated towards the new renewable fuels, such as the ammonia. We know it's expensive, but my case here is that we should be putting the money into this earlier. Of course, we're working in Singapore, we're trying to develop ammonia bunkering infrastructure and so forth here, so that it's ready at the front end. But if we let the IMO just steam through and take a very, very meteoric approach in April and through the year, what we're going to have significantly is that all that will happen is the LNG and biofuels are going to receive incentives, and there's going to be nothing else for the real step change, which will actually achieve the IMO goals of 2050.
Any comments on that from other panelists? And
I would add, it's not criticism, but some of the science of the CO2 equivalent is really not perfected. And to Andrew's point, we have the fuel standard of Fuel EU, and by giving the LNG a bit of a lighter weight, it's relatively well known by now that methane is much more dangerous than CO2 when emitted, and we know that there is methane slip throughout the LNG chain. They're improving the engines, but think about the gas wells that are flaring off and everything else. And when they're not using good science or unmature science, then it becomes political. And the political decision right now has favored LNG, so you're going to see LNG as a favored fuel through 2035 for the EU. I'm not sure we've addressed ammonia slippage, ammonia leak, and then what's the weighted average of nitrous oxide and other releases from the ammonia fuel. So I think it's not criticism, it's just the comment that we also have to get our arms around the science behind what is good and what is not good for the atmosphere.
Yeah, I want to comment on that. I mean, we don't have certainties of what the future will be, and very likely a long period of multi-fuel. We're very clear that achieving net zero by 2050 cannot be done without green methanol and green ammonia. LNG and biofuel and so on, we all know, are transitional fuel. They are available today, so they are an interim solution, but not necessarily the end state. So I think it's important collectively to basically ensure, particularly towards ammonia, that the technology is developing, is safe to use as well. And that's where, you know, it's important that collectively as an industry, we have an understanding of how the process safety is addressed. We know ammonia is a hazardous a gas and it can be lethal up to certain levels. So we have collectively to address the technological development, the safety management, the process safety management, so that collectively us as charter, we are confident that we can also, you know, charter these vessels. So that's one part of the equation, and it's great to see some progress there. But how do we share this component so we collectively have that confidence, that standards and overall, you know, balances as well, and safety is addressed. The second component, to your point, is the economic equation that needs to be addressed. It's more than $200 and $250 per ton of CO2 that we need to basically finance in using today green ammonia, for example. And that, when you look at the carbon prices today, they are far below. They are not, I mean, in some regions, they are around, you know, $100 or euro equivalent, but most of the time, you know, they are actually lower. So we have to have as well a mechanism, an economic mechanism, through the market-based measures as well, what IMO will hopefully, you know, put in place. But not only, we know, unfortunately, it will not be enough. So how we are collectively splitting the bill, that's the fair approach that we are suggesting. So everyone, from ship owners to charterers, to fuel producers, to ports, to the regulator, customers actually through the regulator, can basically support the transition for the future fuels.
Thanks. You would like to add, Rodrigo? We have 8 minutes left, by the way.
Have you looked at the price of carbon when you start to see demand destruction with your clients? Is there that tipping point yet?
Not necessarily at this stage. I mean, one of the things that we're facing, particularly as resource company, and specifically in the iron ore space and the aluminium space, our customers, so steel makers, aluminium producers, have to face as well their decarbonization agenda and have to finance it. So when we are basically between 1 to 3% of their emission, they say, thanks, but no thanks. I've got basically money to invest in decarbonizing steel and the aluminium industry. And as aluminium producer, we understand very well what's the effort in terms of decarbonizing the metal industry. Nonetheless, it's not, you know, for us an option to stand still and wait and see. So ultimately, and that's where we need basically the industry bodies as well to help us prepare for 2050. Because if the world is at net zero by 2050, I'm not sure there will be a lot of fossil fuel left over actually produced on an economic basis for the shipping industry. So we haven't looked at it this way, and we are a little bit on our own from this perspective to actually, through the IMO, to really prepare and invest for the future.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you for that. I would like, given the time constraint, I would like to move on to the final topics, trends in geopolitics, without touching the, you know, the sensitive issues. So we know the ongoing various global conflicts, how they impact the marine industry on a global scale. So obviously it increases the industry's need for safety, and companies would need higher premiums as well to protect their interests and liabilities. So I would like to understand from each of the panelists, how do you structure the costing to cover that risk? And you know, obviously there will be additional extra or extra costs for that. I would be grateful for your views, please. Peter, you would like to start first,
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So in terms of the geopolitical, is that
correct?
Yeah, sure. But yeah, I'll don't know whether I'll dance around the question, but I think like all of us, it's, it remains, you know, pretty uncertain.
Yeah.
You know, the impact of, you know, what we're seeing a bit more tribalism, I guess, in terms of how we're addressing our economics and the tariffs is, as I said, quite uncertain. I think in our business, certainly on our iron ore trade, for example, it feels like the impact will be more indirect rather than direct, and I mean that, I guess, in terms of what sort of impact it might have on economies in terms of slowing it down, and that will, you know, have an impact on growth and infrastructure, which has a direct correlation back into, you know, the large raw materials like iron ore. I think where we are going to see it is more on the smaller vessels, and we've already had sort of those sort of conversations, particularly in the movement of our copper concentrate and chrome, where we will have vessels going into countries where there may be tariffs imposed, and there may also be some flows of cargo that has typically gone into the US is now finding alternative markets, which may be a positive impact for shipping in terms of creating you know, additional ton miles. Might have an adverse effect on some of our commodity prices if it brings some more product into the market. I think in the copper space that's less of a concern where we have you know, a deficit. So I think, as I said, very uncertain. We'll wait and see how it plays out. I think the other element around the tax or the fees around Chinese vessels is, you know, again, still very unknown. Will it be followed through? What sort of impact will it directly have? I think the concern is, again, it's just an extra cost, and it's a cost that's going to be passed down. And that's something that, you know, is not good, I think, for any of the consumers and any of us. And we could probably say the same with the carbon tax as well. There's a lot of taxes being thrown around. So I think that's something, yeah, we keep very close on. Sorry, all conscious right. of time.
Thanks for that. Yeah, Sarah, 3 minutes left.
Sorry. I would just concur. I think, you know, volatility in the freight market, geopolitical tensions, war risks, diversions, these are all part of, you know, what make maritime so interesting. On the US front, you know, I think there's going to be sort of different impacts, whether the container liners or bulk, and definitely I think the medium to smaller owners will potentially bear a bigger burden, you know, if the tariffs are imposed and port charges are imposed. But again, I think, you know, with this sort of regulation overlay now sort of coming into the industry, there is a cost for compliance, and it's just the degree
correct.
At this point.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, Andrew? I think just to very, very quickly summarise, you know, reduce dependency on the fossil fuel. We want to eliminate it from our mines by 2030, so therefore we don't face that volatility risk there. I think on a slightly positive side, we're seeing the cost of some of the technologies reducing substantially, so that should therefore make some of the projects, which we know are expensive, over time reduce. So that's an intangible benefit of the current situation.
Yeah,
thanks for sharing this question with the panel. I was afraid as an American you were going to try to hold me responsible for the latest chaos. But I think it's no secret shipping can benefit from volatility. There's a realignment of trade routes potentially. There's an impact on ton miles. These tend to be good things for our sector. But the negative side, and your question is, how do you price in this risk? And part of it is by not investing in new things, and not necessarily the ship owner or the operator, but the mining companies sitting to my left and right. You know, projects that look really good and sound investment, suddenly I think we're going to see a big drag on major capital investment decisions that's then going to impact, the shipping markets. And then when you look at our own businesses, instead of building a very efficient, purpose-built ship, we might have to look at more general and have a less efficient investment because we have to be prepared for flexibility.
Thank you.
Yeah, Lord? I think, I mean, overall, we have to navigate quite complex environments, and we've seen that over the past years. This is also, you know, what in the end, you know, shipping is focusing at is safe movement of cargoes to the markets, and that's essentially in being quite agile and versatile in a way in resilient to basically navigating quite complex environment, whether they are at the geopolitical level or also, you know, the energy transition going forward. So that's something that is not new to us, which we're taking on board. not always, you know, easy to navigate, but that's definitely the common norm that we have to deal with.
Yeah, Rodrigo, please.
Thank you. Of course, the geopolitical situation is very concerning, but on the short term, I don't see much impact for us. The economies where we trade, operate, we see they are resilient. Specifically about the decarbonization agenda, that's also under discussion. I see this is a long-term commitment from the society, and despite some turbulence that we can see now, this will not change. So I think in the long run, we'll continue doing the same. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for all the panelists. I would offer you, if we had more time, would offer you to ask more, you know, spicier questions towards each other. But time is unfortunately not on our side. But it's been a very good, good, valuable and insightful discussions. Thank you so much for your time.